Today, the Christmas story takes us beyond the manger, beyond the initial excitement a newborn brings into a household and the new routines that are established when everything revolves around the new baby. Sooner or later, baby and parents have to get going back into the real world, exchanging those swaddling clothes for something slightly more substantive to protect a newborn from what will be faced outside the comforts of home. In our New Testament lesson today, Mary and Joseph take baby Jesus to the temple in Jerusalem on the 40th day of his existence and their existence with him, because that's what good Jewish parents do. Now, Luke doesn't get into all of the details of what the law requires, since he either assumes we know them already, or it's not critical to the message he is conveying. For example, he says they will offer a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons as their sacrifice. But what is ultimately required by law is a lamb, unless those who could not afford a lamb, they could bring birds instead. So here we are with this young couple, the Messiah, born a tiny human, and parents who are doing what their parents and their parents' parents and their parents have done for as long as there has been a tradition to do so. Present the baby to God, participate in a purification ritual, and maybe grab some lunch afterwards. Who knows if they woke up that morning with a joyful heart, ready to experience that tradition, or whether one of them muttered to themselves that the tradition was awfully inconvenient. The timing could not be worse, and everyone's expectations surrounding the tradition were just too high. Couldn't we just take care of this business at the temple with God on our own? Maybe write a letter, say a prayer at home, something. And I like to imagine Mary and Joseph on the way to the temple. And Mary is looking around in their things and asks Joseph, "Honey, where did you put the turtle doves? Or did you decide to bring two young pigeons?" And Joseph replies, "I thought you said you were getting those." "Joseph, how would I have time to buy pigeons? Just turn around." Silence. Turn around. And baby Jesus is in the back wondering, are we ever going to make it to the temple? That's just my imagination, of course. I want to make that perfectly clear. But that's the reality of traditions. Detailed experiences that are packed full of meaning, but that require something of us. Our undivided attention, an attitude of expectation, an appreciation for the community that holds that tradition sacred generation after generation. And that's the best thing traditions do for us. They interrupt us, point us forward, call us to something other than ourselves. They bring us together, whether we like that tradition on any particular day or year or not. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that traditions should not be reviewed and refined, reimagined from time to time. Jesus will eventually become the greatest critic of religious people for whom tradition becomes more sacred than the humans who receive meaning from them. But on this day, since he can't really do much more than make sounds and cry, he's like all babies that age, along for the ride, and bringing joy to all whose eyes meet his. So when they arrive to the temple, there are two people who've dreamed a long time for this moment, Simeon and Anna. They will benefit greatly from the keeping of this tradition, but that's not surprising since most traditions have meaning for anyone in the vicinity. And that's true for our traditions as well. And I can't help but think about the down-to-earth realities that take place within local church traditions. Just like Jesus was presented at the temple, we have child dedications. And when we are able to get back together in this sanctuary again, one of the many things we look forward to are those child dedication services. Our tradition is for the pastor to hold the baby and walk the child from the front to the very back, while the parents stand down front praying a three-word prayer. Please don't cry. As the parent, it feels like it's forever, not wanting your child to be the one who will test the acoustics of this historic sanctuary. But what most people don't know is what takes place down in the preschool area, the sacred baby room, where Miss Gwen and volunteers of the church care for the youngest among them. And on dedication day, the parents are in here, usually sitting right up front, maybe second or third row. Then at the end of the service, the baby appears at the door. But have you ever wondered how the baby gets from the baby room into the sanctuary? They don't just crawl up to the door and knock. So you won't be surprised to know that it's an unofficial yet sacred honor to be the volunteer to bring the baby from the baby room into this room. I have witnessed this on many occasions over the past two decades, and so I'm about to give you a behind-the-scenes exclusive. When the parents arrive to church that morning, they go to the baby room, they hand off the child to an adult in the room, and then they begin this litany. The parent says, "I'll be back to get the baby for the dedication." "No, no, no," replies the teacher. "You don't worry. You'll be nervous enough. We'll bring the baby to you when it's time." "Are you sure?" says the parent. "Yes, now run along. We've got this." And they do. Just at the right time, they gather around and get that child out of her or his pajamas and put them into something brought just for this occasion. If the kid has hair, they'll make sure that none are out of place. If a pacifier is to accompany the child, they'll clip it on there, maybe an extra one clipped on the back. Bottle? Check. Socks are on? Check. But are they matching? Check. And off they go, heading to the sanctuary where the parents have sat up close to the front, yet they have not heard a single word of the sermon. Tradition. Now, I am certain a conversation takes place between the baby and the fortunate person who is providing transportation to the sanctuary. It probably goes something like, "You are going to do great. Mom and Dad will be in there. You look wonderful. We are so proud of you." Simeon had a similar heart full of joy when he held baby Jesus in his arms and blessed him. This new life was a promise fulfilled. "A light for revelation to the Gentiles," he says inclusively, "and for glory to your people, Israel." This baby will do something. He is something. Anna's response is similar, and the text says they went and told everyone who was looking for redemption of Israel that the day had finally come. They were dreamers. And this was the moment when dreams became reality. Simeon offers a dose of reality in his words to Mary, and my first reaction is, "Thanks, Simeon, you just ruined the mood. Did you catch what he said to Mary?" He said, "This child is destined for the falling and the rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be opposed so that the inner thoughts of many will be revealed. And a sword will pierce your own soul too." A sword, Mary, will pierce your own soul too. This child has a divine mission. And that mission will bring out the best and the worst in the people he encounters. There will be pain, Mary, and you will experience it as well. We don't know exactly how Mary took these words, whether she played them off in her head, not allowing the gravity of the message to ruin this very special day. We do know, of course, that she will experience pain, as one who faces the grief no human should have to endure, a parent who loses a child. Simeon holds joy and grief together as he pronounces the reality that she will face. And that is part of the Christian journey as well. As commentator Fred Craddock says, anyone who turns on lights creates shadows. Dreams sometimes include nightmares. Have you heard of the African writer Chinua Achebe? He was born in Nigeria in 1930 as a member of the Ibo tribe. His father was Christian, worked for missionaries, and the family sacrificed to provide an education for their children. When he was at the university, he read the great writers from the West, Shakespeare, Milton, Defoe, Swift, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Keats, Tennyson. But then he read novels set in Africa written by Europeans. And even though his professor said these novels were wonderful, he disagreed because Africans were portrayed negatively and unfairly, mainly from a colonial racist perspective. So he wrote his own novel, Things Fall Apart, from an African perspective, which most people credit as the beginning of modern African literature. What Shakespeare was to English literature, one person said at his death, Achebe was to African literature. The book's been translated into something like 57 languages, sold more than 20 million copies. It's a big deal. In the 1980s, he was interviewed by Bill Moyers, and the first question Moyers asked Achebe was to explain the ancient Ibo proverb that went like this. Whenever, wherever something stands, something else will stand beside it. Achebe said that in his culture, nothing is completely absolute in the human experience. Wherever something stands, something else will stand beside it. Along the good stands the bad, but alongside the bad stands the good. I think Simeon and Achebe would agree, and a sword will pierce your own soul too. Ceremonies rooted in tradition that mark our lives are short moments in time. That moment ends, and then we're back on the journey. The gifts are opened and put away. The leftovers fill the refrigerator for another day. And so it was for Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus. The text says, when they had finished everything required by the law, they returned to Galilee, to their own town of Nazareth. The child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Filled with wisdom and covered with the favor of God. Some translations offer a different word than favor. The Greek word is charis. Matthew and Mark do not use this word at all in their Gospels. It has many English translations, including goodwill, loving kindness, and grace. I like all of those words, especially grace. Filled with wisdom and possessed by the grace of God, Jesus continues his journey. And what a journey it will be. Calling people to live differently, act differently, serve differently. Misunderstood by those he loved the most, caring for those others loved the least. Inviting everyone he meets to join him on the journey. 2020 will soon come to an end. This year, our traditions have been challenged in ways we could not have expected. Church traditions, family traditions, but we are resilient people just as the generations before us. And we remember that wherever something stands, something else will stand beside it. And that something else, that faith and unrelenting hope that the future will not be as the present, is shaped and grounded in the traditions that are sustaining us, even in their absence. And so we continue the journey with wisdom and grace, creating the future with God for ourselves and others, young and old. Amen.